Good evening. I am Alan Gervey, and this is Gervey's Law. I don't even know how I have a voice left to talk tonight. I'm exhausted. I'm tired. I have no voice left. I've been coaching all weekend, coached my son's baseball team. We lost, 9-year-old baseball team. Hockey team, we won. Today, the football team, we tied, and my daughter, my 8-year-old daughter's softball team, and we won. I am exhausted, and last night I went to the Duran Duran concert at the Hollywood Bowl. That was a lot of fun, but I'm not sure that so many old people should be allowed to dance in their seats. It's just, like, weird. It's the 80s and 90s progressive band, and I don't know. But it was fun. It was a great concert, and I am so exhausted, don't have a voice, but thankfully... And I say thankfully, I am so excited today to actually have a professional interviewer, an award-winning interviewer, to pick up the slack because she can talk where I may collapse. She's never been a loss for words, and I'm talking now about Ashley Banfield. She's the host of Banfield on the News Nation Network. It airs 10 p.m. Eastern Time. And that covers top news stories and features interviews with a lot of newsmakers, politicians, celebrities. She's the former host of Legal View with Ashley Banfield and early start on CNN. Also hosted Primetime Justice on HLN and Open Court, which was formerly hosted by Lisa Bloom, by the way, who's on our show often. And that was on Court TV, renamed True TV. She's been a correspondent for ABC News. She's got a great story that we need to hear about Peter Jennings. We'll hear about that later. ABC News, she's reported for Good Morning America 2020, ABC World News Tonight, and then, of course, as a correspondent for NBC for the Today Show, NBC Nightly News, Dateline. She's known for her coverage of Afghanistan. She's won a number of awards, journalistic awards, including an Emmy for reporting in Dallas, and she's anchored several MSNBC primetime series, was host of Homepage, A Region of Conflict, and she has a lot to talk about September 11th, 9/11, her harrowing story that she will tell us as we commemorate 9/11 today, September 11th, 2022. And no better person to have someone who was there at the time. But probably what's most important about Ashley Banfield is that she's from my hometown. That's the most important thing. I don't often get a chance to talk to Winnipeg people. We've interviewed Bobby Hull, had a great hour with Bobby Hull, who has an association with Winnipeg, being on the Jets back in the day. Randy Backman, a few weeks ago, he spoke to us and he talked fondly of his roots in Winnipeg. And we had Bob Irving on. And a lot of you don't know who he is, but he's a celebrated Winnipeg Blue Bombers broadcaster who retired. So now we get Ashley Banfield, who grew up in my hometown. And she spent a lot of time. I spoke earlier this summer. My kids went to camp in Lake of the Woods in Ontario, Kenora, Ontario. And they went to their first sleepaway camp, 8 and 9-year-old Hudson and Harper, first sleepaway camp. And Lake of the Woods, a very special place for Ashley Banfield. And without further ado, and there's been a lot of ado here, Ashley, welcome to Gervey's Law.
Hey, Alan, it's great to talk to you. How are you?
I am doing great. So did you know about our connection in Winnipeg?
I did not know. And the kids went to camp where I spend every summer. That's so exciting.
It is so beautiful there. And I took my wife there. She'd never been. And it was relaxing. They were gone at the sleepaway camp. And we really enjoyed the area. Why do you love Lake of the Woods so much? Tell our listeners what they're missing.
You know, it's most people know nothing about it. It's this wonderful little secret. It's a lake that has 14,000 islands in it, which blows most people away.
A few islands.
It's just a couple. It spans over the border with Minnesota, and it's just a stunning place to be. And my family has been there for 7 generations, as have many of the other families. And so going back there is almost like going back to see all your, you know, your cousins and friends who were friends 100 years ago, you know, their offspring have maintained that generational connection. It's really delightful. Plus, it's a boater's paradise, right? You can't go anywhere unless you know how to drive a boat, unless you have a boat, because it's all island to island.
That's right. And, you know, when I dropped my kids off, they were going to an island, of course, Town Island in Lake of the Woods, and they knew no one. They'd never been there before, grew up in L.A., never been to Winnipeg. They'd heard a lot about it for 8 and 9 years. They kept hearing about Winnipeg. Finally got a chance to not only taste Jeannie's cake and not only go to the bridge drive-in, but they actually went on a boat to Lake of the Woods where we dropped them off. They didn't know a soul, and they survived. So I give them credit. You know.
So they were, let me guess, did they go to BB Camp?
They did. You know BB yep. Camp. Yeah. So they went there. I had gone there as a child only once. I ended up going to basketball camp at the International Peace Gardens because I think I liked it better. But I didn't tell them that. I told them they were going to love it, and they had a great time. They saw Devil's Island on the way on the boat. And some of the places that I know, you know, the beautiful sunsets. One of the things they did complain about, Ashley, was the mosquitoes. They were running rampant.
I knew you were going to say that. That's the one drawback is black flies and mosquitoes can be pretty, you know, they can be like Volkswagen, you know, they're pretty big and gnarly. But we grew up just, you know, with mosquito repellent. And yeah, and I don't even really, it doesn't bother me anymore.
You know, they felt that the kids there and the counselors were so nice. They were down to earth. There was such a community. And I know you've often talked about that with Winnipeg. There was a beautiful community supporting each other. And I think there were development of old-fashioned values, something that I think maybe has been something important in your career. You know, like journalists should actually think about maybe being impartial rather than being cheerleaders. And I know you've called it, you know, this is not a sport, journalism. Perhaps maybe people should think about being impartial and give the facts. In your development, when you were growing up in Winnipeg, going to Balmoral Hall and understanding a little bit about politics and about the world, how did you develop this kind of fascination with being a real journalist, not just being a cheerleader?
I had a really lucky epiphany when I was 14 years old in ninth grade. The curriculum in Canada at that point required British history to be taught in ninth grade. And so there I was in Mrs. Sharp's British history class, learning about King John and the Magna Carta and thinking, somebody had to write all this down. You know, somebody had to be the first one to write it all down and make it the public record. And it's the record that we all now live and die by. And that's a really important job. Like, you can't screw that up. And I remember thinking what an amazing job it would be to be at the front line of recording history. First of all, seeing it first, and then being the one who can trumpet it to others. And so really, really lucky at that young age, I thought, gosh, I'd really like to be a foreign correspondent. And so that's sort of how my love of the business was born. I thought right from the, you know, get-go, once I graduated from university, I'll get into the business of reporting and see if I can't get my way over to Beirut.
And Afghanistan and everywhere else. But at the same time, you had some confidence instilled in you. You watched your mother, who was involved in real estate with a women's firm. And how did that impact your ability to want to be independent, to go off to places like Beirut, go off to Afghanistan, not be afraid as a woman, be able to stand up and really compete with men, which can sometimes be difficult because of people's just their prejudices and biases?
Well, I think, you know, first and foremost, having the example in my household of a breadwinner who was a woman in the 60s and 70s, that's pretty crazy. You know, that just set the groundwork right there for it being normal. You know, there were all sorts of obstacles that, you know, I would discover on my journey as well for being a woman in business, but especially on television and news. But I think, you know, her counsel was always grit your teeth and nose to the grindstone. Don't complain. Get it done. And that was really good because I think it helped me to develop the grit that everybody needs. You know, everybody requires an essential element of grit in their character in order to be able to persevere through really tough times in whatever endeavor they choose, whether it's sports or whether it's career or whether it's motherhood. We all need that essential element of grit just so that we don't collapse, right, under the strain and pressure of obstacles. So she helped me develop a lot of that grit. But she also gave really good advice in terms of, I think this probably sounds so 70s, but she said, you know, you get a whole lot more with honey than you do with vinegar.
Well, that's true. That's very true.
Yeah. So
you know, it's great advice. And you know, we're going to talk a little, we're going to take a break in a minute, but we're going to talk a little bit later about mentorship and how important it has been, the program that you've done with mentoring not only women, but, you know, young journalists, people who want to advance in their career. I think that kind of advice is something that not everyone hears about. And sometimes in the competitive world, they lose sight of it. For you, What is that something that started your whole interest in mentoring others?
You know, I think I'm in my 34th year, or I'm in my 35th year. Gosh, I can't believe it.
You're talking about your 34th year of life, not in your career, because if anyone looks, you know, look at Ashley, she looks like she's 34. We're not going to say if she's 38 or 9, but definitely 34 years in a career is something else. She started when she was in her diapers.
Yeah, I wish I could say that. It's definitely my 34th year of TV. And back then, in the beginning, there was zero mentorship. I don't know that the men were getting a whole lot either, in my business anyway. And the word mentor really didn't even become sort of, I don't know, regularly uttered until the last, I'd say, 5 or 10 years. I hate to say it, but it's really kind of a new and hip way of thinking about, you know, giving back. And so I plodded through and made all my mistakes and had to learn the hard way. And I just think it's such a simple metric to just give those out freely to help people advance quicker and focus on the important stuff. Because right now the important stuff for me is keeping this career a pristine endeavor. Being a journalist.
Well that ship already sailed, unfortunately. Keeping it a pristine endeavor. For you, not maybe, but for others, not so much. And I think we have to talk more about that because, you know, we can talk about Katie Kirk, we can talk about Peter Jennings, two very diametrically opposed stories that you have with respect to mentoring and with respect to supporting each other. Would you agree with me?
Oh, yeah, no, I definitely think so.
All right, that's the cliffhanger. We got to take a break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk a little bit about Ashley Banfield's story with Peter Jennings and how she got started with ABC and maybe a little bit about Katie Kirk and NBC, and maybe there was a little bit of a difference there. Stay tuned. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC. That's not an original. I think that's a cover. The Short Bus. That was done by The Short Bus. Huh. Ashley, does that mean anything to you?
I know that band. They're fantastic.
Oh, really? What a coincidence. They played at your wedding.
They did. And I just saw them last weekend.
No way. You did?
I did.
Where?
Yes, they're fantastic. They were playing at an end of summer party in Connecticut, and I wasn't going to go. And then I decided to go last minute, and I ended up there till closing, of course, because they are so good.
It's amazing. And yeah, we're going to talk a little bit more about your wedding another time, because how many people have a surprise wedding? Maybe someone has a surprise 50th birthday, but a surprise wedding? I don't know. Another teaser. We're going to get back to it. You know, we heard in the break they talked about 9/11, 2001. We will never forget. That is something that Ashley Banfield will never forget for good reason. And we're teasing that, and not that it's a tease. But I want to finish up with the Katie Kirk, Peter Jennings dichotomy here because it's important when we talk about the development of your career, Ashley, and then we'll talk a little bit about 9/11 and what you experienced. So take us back to, 1991 with Peter Jennings. You did something that a lot of people, young people, don't do Very much anymore. And it's a lesson. And I want people, this is mentoring. Anyone listening, listen to what Ashley Banfield did to get a gig with the ABC.
Oh, it was pretty crazy. At the time, the whole year, 1991, I was traveling around the world with a backpack, literally backpacking around the strangest parts of the world. And I took the Trans-Siberian Railway from Beijing to Moscow, which is 6 days long. And in Moscow, learned that there was, because I'd been out of the mix for quite some time, learned that there was a summit, Bush-Gorbachev summit in Moscow. And I thought, well, isn't this perfect timing? I'm going to go knock on some doors and see if I can't, you know, get a temporary gig. I'll offer my services for free. That's what I'll do. And I knocked on ABC, CBS, NBC's door, and everybody said, no, thanks. We're fine. We don't need free services. But ABC said, sure, we'll take you. And I just was running scripts and running messages and running notebooks. And I was 23 years old, I think. And I said I would do anything, and didn't want any pay. Just wanted to be able to work with them for the duration of the summit, which was just a couple of days. And then all of a sudden, I was asked to run something upstairs to the roof where Jennings was broadcasting. They said, oh my God, there's been a crisis. There's Lithuanian border guards that have been shot, and Peter needs to know, and the radio is not working. So you got to run up there with these notes and you got to pass them to him.
Wow.
So I did what I was asked, and I ran up to the set, and I kind of signaled that I had to get these notes into the set, and I creaked along on my knees to stay out of the camera shot and like held the notes up to Peter while he was broadcasting so that he could reach down and he could take the notes. And then he broadcast the breaking news, and they got it on the air very quickly. And for that, Peter was always extremely thankful, and he repaid me, which was very kind, by agreeing to look over my resume tape when I got back to America, actually Canada at the time, and give me a couple of pointers, which he did. He always honored that. He also allowed me to, when I was in New York, to come and visit the ABC Nightly Newsroom, or the ABC World News Tonight Newsroom, and watch and do a broadcast. So it was very exciting.
It's incredible because it leads to so many things. People now, and I know because I run a law firm, and so many people come to me and they want so much money to start with, young lawyers, people just graduating from law school. And I remember back at that time when you were doing that with Peter Jennings, I went into NBC as a young lawyer and I said, I want to work here. I was friends with someone on a television show called Saved by the Bell. They did the Saved by the Bell show. The head of the legal department said, we don't have any jobs. I said, I don't want to get paid. I'm just volunteering. They said, we don't have any offices. I said, I saw a conference room back there. I don't need an office. And, you know, they said, well, when would you start? I said, I'm ready to start right now. Long story short, I ended up working at NBC. They finally, they gave me a job. They offered a job. But it's the same kind of thing. Why people don't do what you did, what I did back in the early 90s, to get your career started and think you're investing in your future. Why are kids different now?
I don't know. It's a very different mentality now. I think kids coming out of university have probably spent so much more money than we ever had to.
Yeah.
That there is no free lunch. Like they've got to start paying off those student loans right away. I mean,
unless the student loans are forgiven. So.
Yeah, that's a whole other story.
Yeah.
Anyway, it did pay off dividends though, because the next summit was in Vancouver, Canada, and it was a new president and a new Russian president as well. It was Clinton Yeltsin. So I got lucky because ABC said, we'll scoop you up right away. You're Canadian and we could really use a Canadian fixer. So I ended up getting another whole gig with ABC. It always pays off in dividends. No matter what gig you accept, it's going to pay off in dividends. So even when you're tired, exhausted, you don't think you're getting paid properly or respected enough, it's always going to yield something. That's my mentality.
And it worked well for you. What made you feel like you were ready for a transition from Canada to the United States? Was it something you always had dreamed of, or it was just a better opportunity at the time?
You know, I'd always looked south of the border for the opportunities in America. The media is very different in America. It's a very big business here. It's a very blue-collar small business in Canada, and there's not a lot of room for advancement. And there were only, you know, two top jobs in the country, and then a few other, you know, semi-top jobs. They're very, very small in terms of opportunity in Canada. So, and I didn't want to necessarily stay with local news. You know, I wanted to move into national and then, you know, obviously international and war correspondence, and, right. and that seemed to just afford way more opportunity in the U.S. And so that's why I sort of lit the fire and scooted down to New York and looked for an agent and found an agent. And then, you know, the rest is history.
Do you think back then Canada wasn't open as much to women journalists or broadcasters? We had Knowlton Nash and we had Lloyd Robertson. Later on, clearly things have changed. But at that time, were you struggling with that?
You know, interestingly, no. I think Canada had Barbara Frum. And for any American listeners, if you recognize the name Frum, F-R-U-M, you probably recognize it from David Frum, who was George W. Bush's chief speechwriter and is a regular commentator, conservative commentator on television. Barbara Frum is his mother, and she was a tour de force
right.
on television. The Ted Koppel of Canada. And she was a Ted Koppel back in the 80s, you know, so... I think I probably looked at her as a real model and as a real, you know, someone to aspire to, you know, that position I could aspire to because she had it. And so no, I don't necessarily think that it was as male dominated in Canada as it was in the U.S. There were no Barbara Frums to my knowledge back then.
Well, there was a Barbara Walters. She was.
Yeah, but he didn't have that top show, you know.
No. Well, Barbara Frum. Yeah.
Prime show.
That's true. And it was very sad because her death was much too young. She was such a, like you say, tour de force. And you're right. It just, people respect.
Frum, not Barbara Walters.
No, Barbara. No, Barbara Frum. Barbara Frum.
Yeah, Barbara Frum, I think she was my age. I think she died at, you know,
she did.
Around 54 or so. Yeah.
Yeah, and it was, you know, and she was still at the top of her game, and it was cancer, unfortunately. But, you know, it's interesting because you took a more difficult route. You have said that, you know, the media in the United States is much more difficult than Canada, and you have to have tougher skin. You've got to be elephant-skinned, as you've said. But apparently that didn't turn you away. You still faced it and said, I'm going to do this.
Yeah, I don't know that I knew it was going to be so much more competitive in that respect, that there'd be so much more criticism. I just thought there was bigger opportunity, and that's why I wanted to, you know, to work south of the border, south of the Canadian border.
Right. But I
really didn't know how ugly it could get because, of course, social media wasn't even a glimmer, you know, in the developer's eyes. So. Once social media kind of hit the scene, many of us have really had to do an about face and say, oh my God, that it is really cruel out there. Like I think the individual person that would throw a peanut at the screen and say, I'm not fond of her, never affected us. But when they can get their community together and really sort of group bully, then it's a very different animal, you know, being in the public eye.
Yeah, very, very difficult. We need to take a quick break. And we will do that in a few seconds. We come back. We're going to talk to Ashley Banfield about 9/11 and what she experienced. And we'll talk more about her show, Banfield. It's on News Nation Network. And you can see it every day, 10 p.m. Eastern time. And that's 10 in L.A. time as well, correct, Ashley?
Yeah, it repeats at 2 in the morning Eastern, so 10 p.m.
Right.
Pacific as well.
Yep. All right. Well, we're talking to Ashley Banfield, and you're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC. All right. We're back. Boy, a lot of Winnipeg flavor today. We're talking to Ashley Banfield. That is Chantel Kreviazek. Remember Chantel,
is Ashley? Ever. Oh, I was just saying, oh my gosh, that's Chantel Kreviazek singing. She went to my school and we sang together.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, we sang. She was 6 years younger than me. And she and I sang at my graduation. So she was in sixth grade and I was in 12th. And we sang, you know, for the graduating class. Yeah, we did a duet together in harmony. I think we did something from Simon and Garfunkel.
Oh, wow. Is that at Balmoral Hall?
That's correct.
Wow. I mean, you must have a great voice because Chantel, I mean, incredible voice.
Well, let's not compare us because she was in sixth grade at the time and she was like ridiculously talented then. And she just got better and better and better.
That's amazing. Wow. I had no idea.
A lot more talented than I am.
And when was the last time you heard a song by her?
Well, I listen to her stuff all the time because I actually have her, I hate to say CDs, but I bought her CDs so long ago and it's in my digital playlist.
That's
and stuff.
That's fantastic.
Because I adore her. But we talk every so often. She's also a really good friend of Justin Trudeau.
Oh, I didn't know that. Huh.
Yeah, I didn't know it either.
Did she sing for him at any of the official events?
I don't know. It's quite possible, but she just happened to let me know that a while ago we were chatting about where she was. Over Christmas, we were texting, and she sent me a picture. She said, I'm at this dinner table right now. It's just her family and Justin Trudeau's family. I guess they're close enough that they were having Christmas dinner, just the two families together.
That's amazing. It's nice to stay in touch with these people. One person that you probably don't stay in touch with is Katie Couric, though. And we mentioned it before the break. She came out in her book and said that she was, threatened by you? You're someone who is so supportive of other journalists, other women, others in general, and you believe, like we talked about, in mentoring. What was up with Katie, and why did she say these things?
I don't know. I found it really disappointing. I understood it because from Katie's perspective, she saw me, showing up at this news network, and for whatever reason, she thought that I was a threat. From my perspective, I was a complete peon. Nobody knew who I was. I came from Dallas, Texas. I emigrated through Dallas. I was a local anchor in Dallas. So on the national scene, nobody knew me from Adam. But from her perspective, she said this was not a time when a lot of women helped other women. And she said I didn't feel, I think her words were, she said I felt less charitable about helping the new kids on the block. I felt like it was a little different than that. But I do understand in the late 90s, early 2000s, women were still struggling to stay on the air after the age of 40. And so I understand probably why she felt the way she did. I just wish that I had had her help because I really needed it.
Yeah.
I needed as much advice and guidance as I could get in this business, especially in this, fledgling cable news industry. I mean, it was just, CNN was the only game in town. So when Fox and MSNBC got on the board, this was a brand new kettle of fish and really hard to navigate. And so I really could have used her help. P.S. I was a huge fan. I mean, Katie, I held in such esteem, and she was so untouchable because she was just that big a star. She was that successful. I admired that she was so brave in her career as to get on a national network morning show and dare to be authentic, dare to be herself, dare to laugh when it warranted laughing, dare to be sweet to guests when it was warranted. She dropped the whole Cronkite facade that so many women tried to emulate and said, to hell with it, I'm going to be me. And it worked. I mean, it was a huge risk. She was brave enough to take it, and it paid off in dividends for her. And so I think she's the gold standard to this day of being authentic on television. I just wish that I'd had a great professional relationship with her, but it wasn't to be.
But, it's so motivating to hear you say that, because I'm thinking in my situation with young lawyers, hearing you say that makes me think that I'm going to try even harder to help younger attorneys. And everyone can do it in their own profession because it's so meaningful. And for you to speak that way, you were going to be successful regardless of what Katie did. So why couldn't Katie just step up and help and show you the ropes? You both were like-minded, and it just makes you realize, treat people with respect, help people, and things are going to turn out well for you. So I appreciate
I will say this. I don't begrudge her for the way things were at that time. Had she done that now, I think it'd be different. But back then it was different. And she probably didn't feel as secure as she should have in her position. But I think women didn't feel very secure in their positions no matter what. Don't forget how she ascended to that position. They wiped out two women before her. So I get it. I get how what the competitive field felt like. I don't besmirch how she felt.
Right.
I think the way in which she carried out certain, you know, pieces of business were inappropriate. But I will say this also, it's not just good for the soul to help those guys you're talking about and those women in the law firm and to reach down and help more young people. It's good business.
Yeah.
Because these people, many of them will skyrocket and fly past you.
Absolutely.
And eventually you're going to calling them for contacts, business, help, and you name it. It's just a good investment. Even if you're a lousy person, it's a good business investment to mentor, you know, the next group.
And for lousy people, that means something when they think about good business.
Yeah.
I'm going to change the subject a little bit, a little more serious right now. It is September 11th. We want to talk a little bit about September 11th. You were there. Tell us your story.
Yeah. So on the morning of the 11th, I was getting ready to go to work, which was across the Hudson River in New Jersey at MSNBC, where I did a live show every day with Lester Holt. And instead of going to work, I was just coming back from a run and about to jump in the shower. And I always had the Today Show on. Boom. I saw what had happened, the North Tower. The North Tower was on fire, right? North Tower was on fire, and the reporting at the time from the Today Show was it looks like a small biplane has hit the North Tower. And I thought right away, this is going to be a really big story today. It looks like, you know, it looks like the Towering Inferno, that movie from the 70s. And so I called the desk at MSNBC, and I said, guys, I think I should just go straight down there and report from there and go live from there, as opposed to coming out and anchoring my show from, you know, New Jersey. And there was a lot of back and forth about it. And it said, in the meantime, I'm going to jump in the shower because I'm in. Jumped in the shower, got out of the shower, and just as I got out of the shower watching it, and I saw the second plane hit, and I said, oh, my God, I am going down there. This is war. Not coming out there. There, no more debating. The debate's over. It's no longer Towering Inferno. It's the apocalypse. Actually, it wasn't the apocalypse yet. It became the apocalypse.
You didn't know it yet.
I didn't know it yet. So I raced out of the house and I grabbed, you know, a couple of things and I jumped. I went down to the subway and right away heard the announcement. There are no trains. Everything has frozen. We're in, you know, crisis. Ran back up to the street level, grabbed a cab. Cab took me as far as he dared. And then he said, get out. No one's going any further south than this. And we had been, you know, passing just throngs of people running northward. And so the rest of the 40 blocks, I ran on foot against the sea of people running, you know, away from the zone. And I watched the first tower come down. You know, I watched the south tower, which was the second one to be hit, came down first.
And you actually saw that?
I watched it happen.
Wow.
And I just was frozen in my tracks thinking, was that supposed to happen? Why am I amazed by this? I guess that's what happens in, you know, infernos like that. But I was trying to process everything at the same time. Meanwhile, every car, as they kept running south, all the doors, they were stopped. Every car was stopped and all the doors were open. And I could hear a radio station playing. It's a famous radio station in New York City, a news radio station called 1010 Winds. And I could hear the reports as I ran past every car. And that's kind of how I was hearing what was happening on a more granular level. And then, you know, eventually the people who were running northward became, you know, people covered in ash who were running northward and first responders who were running northward. And many of them were yelling, turn around, turn around. And I kept going thinking, well, that other tower is not going to come down. You know, the calamity just got even bigger. I have to report on this. And as I got within, it's really hard to determine exactly where I was at this moment. It was within about two blocks, maybe a block and a half of footprint. And because I know I looked up, I strained my head way up and I could see the North Tower coming down. And I only had a few seconds to sort of think. and turned and ran, but got hit with the debris. Luckily, heavy debris, just the forceful cloud of it, you know. And it went pitch black. It went to midnight instantly. Just, I could not believe what was happening. It just went to midnight. And I remember as it was going black, I could see a building, you know, to my right, and I could see roughly where the door was before it, literally all the lights went out. And then the person I was running with broke the bottom portion of the window of the doorway, this glass doorway, and we crawled on our hands and knees under it, and then, you know, basically did a judo kick of the inner door to get even further away from this suffocating cloud. Wow. And in the interim, I had a second shirt around my shoulders. It was like a cardigan, you know. Yeah, it wasn't a sweater, it was a cardigan shirt. And I took the sleeve of that cardigan shirt and I wrapped it around my mouth when that cloud hit and the lights went out, because it was impossible to breathe, right? It was just all grit and dust. So I was breathing through my shirt sleeve until I could get in that vestibule of that building and sort of breathe again. But it was the most terrifying thing.
I, you know, the way you're describing it, it's like it's happening right now. It's amazing how, well, not amazing, I guess it's expected, the indelible memory that you have, it's like it happened yesterday.
Well, I'll tell you what else is seared in my mind. I had a Motorola flip phone that I had been dialing, constantly trying to, you know, connect with my control room so I could report live over the phone as I was running. I got on with them one time as I was running southward toward the building, so I was able to report and tell them exactly what I was seeing in real time as the building was coming down, the first one. And then the call got cut off, and I had been dialing, probably 100 times in a row, and got another call through. And that second call through to the control room came through when I was in that vestibule, and daylight was just starting to come back, like, you know, just like 4 a.m. kind of just starting. And when the line was answered, I screamed at the top of my lungs. And I remember hearing my own voice and not even recognizing it, thinking like, oh my God, that's what terrorized, you know, that's what you sound like when you're terrorized or terrified or within an inch of death. I remember screaming, don't let the call drop. 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 You're the only people who know we're here. You know, I really thought that this was going to be the last person I was going to speak with. And I thought the building that we were in was going to come down too. You know, your mind just works in very weird ways.
I can imagine.
In a completely unfathomable, flummoxing, perplexing, apocalyptic moment, you know. And so I did think that we had to get out of that building. We had to get out of it. That's the most crazy thinking, right?
Yeah.
It was as safe as we could be. But we had to get out of there because all of these buildings were going to come down, you know. And so the girl who answered the phone, I call her a girl because we were probably, you know, in our early 30s. Her name was Amika, and she worked on my show. And I just remember Amika was, I think she's an executive producer now at MSNBC, but she sounded like she was terrified to learn what it was like with that person calling from the scene within, you know, within minutes of that North Tower coming down. She was sort of dumbfounded and shell-shocked as well. But the call didn't drop. And I was able to report, you know, I almost think I was hyperventilating, you know, like a little kid when they cry and they can't get out. Yeah, I feel like I might have sounded like that.
Jeez. You know, it makes it so real hearing that story. And thank you for sharing it with us. I know it's difficult, you know, when you think about it, every 9/11, which is today, to be reminded. And of course, you know, we think of all those who perished in 9/11, whose stories, you know, obviously were different than yours. The outcome, you have gone on to be able to cover so many events, and I'm sure that's one that will never be forgotten. We have to take a quick break. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC. We're talking to Ashley Banfield. Don't tell me, Ashley, that you know the crash test dummies, right?
Yes, I do.
No!
Yeah, I do, because Benjamin Darville, who's sort of the really strawberry blonde one, we went to school together at Grosvenor School in Winnipeg and River Heights.
Well, that's where I grew up, in River Heights on Elm Street, so I wasn't far from Grosvenor School.
That's right. I was on Kingsway.
You were in a better area. Our area was okay, but you were in North River Heights, which were the older and nicer houses. And you know, going to Grosvenor, we went to Montrose, and I ended up at Grant Park. In fact, speaking of Grant Park, I got a message a couple days ago from Jocelyn Thorvaldson, who is an old friend, and Karen. Both of them went to school with me, and they said to say hi to you.
So Karen is my former sister-in-law. Oh, a small world is crazy. I want your listeners to know Winnipeg is actually really big. It's like 950,000 people, if not a million.
And you know all of them.
No.
And it's
a weird confluence.
Yes.
Confluence of us knowing a lot of the same people. It is really weird, but I guess it happens.
And I haven't seen I haven't seen Joss or Karen for so many years. I haven't been back in Winnipeg for a long time, but, you run across them and, great memories. Let's move on. We've got a few more minutes. I want to talk a little bit about, your 50th birthday. Tell us what happened on your 50th birthday. It's one of the best stories I've ever heard.
Well, decided to get married on my 50th birthday to my husband, Chris Hayner. And we were figuring out, well, what can we do that's, you know, not a big hassle, right? And we decided, because we skied at this ski club in Vermont, we'd invite just our own little families, right? My mom and my three siblings and their spouses, and his brothers and their spouses and their kids, and my nieces and nephews. And that we'd ask them to come skiing. We let them know it's important, and they didn't have a choice because it was going to be a wedding. But we didn't tell anybody else in the ski club, right? So après ski, everybody's having beer, and there's a guy on the guitar, as there always is, about 500 people in the ski club all, you know, having après ski drinks and having a great time. And then the guy on the guitar sort of stops playing, and he goes pop, pop, pop on the mic. "Excuse me, everybody, I'm just going to take a really quick break so that this can happen." And then the wedding march played, and my husband took off his ski jacket, and he's got a suit underneath, and my family all took off their ski jackets, and they've all got nice clothes underneath. And then I came down the staircase in a nice, pretty wedding dress, and we got married at the giant fireplace as a pop-up wedding. It was a total surprise.
How amazing, because most of the time it's you who is surprised, but you surprised your audience.
Yeah. We just thought, you know what? It's a great environment. We all love skiing. What a wonderful way to kind of just, you know, do something really low organizational, low cost, low everything, and still have a really great time. So, and there was already a band that was scheduled to play that night. So we're like, oh, that works.
That's really incredible. And, you know, you made sure that everyone had great food, some encrusted something or other that you coordinated to make it all worthwhile.
I can't believe you know that, because I don't even remember. I mean, honestly, we went and tasted the food the day before. I said, yeah, it's fine, whatever. You know, like, I don't care.
But you liked that it was encrusted. You didn't know what was encrusted, but that was the selling point, and it was delicious.
It was great. Everything was great. The cake was
amazing.
Really pretty. It was all like, the whole thing was like winter, like Christmas winter theme. So I carried a bunch of pine boughs instead of flowers.
Wow. And, that's amazing.
And the cake was sitting on a sawed off log, you know, like the cross section of a big log, and the cake was on top of that. It was beautiful.
And it wasn't a genie's cake, though.
It was not a genie cake.
Okay, good. I don't know if Chris would have liked it or not. Some people who aren't from Winnipeg, my wife doesn't like genie's cakes. But you guys met on Match.com, and it's funny because a few weeks ago, we had Alicia Silverstone on, and she's been using these dating apps. She was talking about her and Drew Barrymore. She was telling me that the dating apps have been great for her. Talk about someone like Ashley Banfield on Match.com meeting the love of your life.
Well, you know, I'll tell you what, I was really hesitant to do it, but then I saw Martha Stewart on the Today Show telling the host, like, what are you talking about? Of course I'm on Match.com. Are you, like, you know, a dinosaur? And she really, you know, she was so funny the way she said it and made it so normal. I thought, well, then if Martha Stewart's doing it, I'm going on Match. And so I did. And it took a year, but I met, you know, Chris Hayner, the love of my life, and we got married 3 years later.
That's amazing. Only have a couple minutes left. Let's talk a little bit about your program, Banfield, on News Nation. Now, is Chris Cuomo joining News Nation?
He is.
It's amazing.
Yes, I think October 3rd is his premiere. We're very excited because Chris is a, you know, he's a tour de force. I worked with him at CNN. And no matter what your politics, the guy is a remarkable communicator. You know, he really is a great communicator. And the great thing about News Nation is that we've launched to be unbiased. And so we do a lot of yin-yang.
You're
so
still going to have to talk to Chris a little bit about that because, you know, Dan Abrams, who's been on the show before, and I love Dan, he's great. I wouldn't say, and I know Chris and Dan are good friends, but, you know, Dan is a little more unbiased than Chris.
Well, and I think Chris is probably going to tailor what he does and who he books accordingly. And of course we yin and yang. So
yeah.
If somebody has a show that leans a little bit right, then the next guy is going to have guests that lean a little bit left, or at least is going to compliment.
Yeah.
The one thing we don't do is we don't just put a full lineup of bias by omission, you know, or bias by cheerleading. And that's what's great. You can't speak entirely in an unbiased way. All you can do is hope to interject all sides and at least have a discussion about it.
Yes.
Even if one side sounds preposterous, you have to include it and
yeah.
allow people to believe. They have to be able to choose. You can't dictate how people should.
And it's going to be a great lineup, though, when you have Cuomo, Banfield, and Abrams. That's an excellent lineup. You know, good friend of the show, Ann Bremner, who's on a lot, can't speak highly enough about you. So...
I really like Ann too. She's really smart. I do adore her.
And people can check out the Casey Anthony trial that the reporting, Ashley Banfield on the Casey Anthony. We don't have time to talk about that, but I know Ann Bremner is involved and Jose Baez, who's been on the show a couple times as well. So many great things to get from Ashley Banfield. She tweets at TV Ashley, at TV Ashley. She can be seen on Banfield, on News Nation Network.
And one other thing, Alan.
Go ahead.
Rising Tide. I invite all of your listeners to just Google Ashley Banfield Rising Tide and then sign up for my seminars. They're free. You can listen to all of these incredible mentors, like George Stephanopoulos is coming up. Lester Holt, I've done. Savannah Guthrie's coming up.
Don't forget Gail King. That's a great one.
Gail King, Sanjay Gupta, Lisa Ling, Billy Bush. I mean, I have all these great leaders, and they all do these free seminars.
We have to do another show just on Rising Tide. It's amazing. It's great work. And we'll have to do another show and get some of these people on. Thank you so much, Ashley, for joining us. It's been a great hour speaking with you.
Thanks for having me. It's been great to see you.
All right. Take care. Thanks for listening to Gerv's Law. See you next week.